You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show on Joy 1250.
Well, in 1982, 16-year-old Marina Nemet was arrested on false charges by Iranian Revolutionary Guards and tortured in Tehran's notorious Evin prison. At a time when most Western teenage girls are choosing their prom dresses, Nemet was having her feet beaten by men with cables and listening to gunshots as her friends were being executed. She survived only because one of the guards fell in love with her and threatened to harm her family if she refused to marry him. Soon after her forced conversion to Islam and marriage, her husband was assassinated by rival factions. Nemet was returned to prison, but ironically, it was her captor's family who eventually secured her release. An extraordinary tale of faith and survival, Prisoner of Tehran, is a testament to the power of love in the face of evil and injustice. Marina Nemet is the website, marinanemet.com. It's M-A-R-I-N-A. Nemat, N-E-M-A-T.com. And first thing I'm going to ask Marina is if I'm pronouncing her name correctly. Marina, how am I doing?
You're doing well.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm sorry our show ran a little late.
Not at all. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I watched your interview on The Hour with George Strombolopoulos, and I've seen you in other media. Boy, this story really caught the attention of the world. Why do you think that the world just kind of really gravitated to you, your story, and your book?
To be honest with you, when I decided to write my story, I didn't think at all about how the world was going to react because I had bigger problems on my hands. You know, when something like that happens to you at a very young age, even though you're young, and in a way the young are more resilient, but the problem was that after I was released, nobody wanted to talk about it. Basically, the first night I was home with my parents, we sat around the dinner table. I had been in prison for more than 2 years, and they talked about the weather. So nobody wanted to know. This is what happens when sometimes people face extreme trauma. They look the other way.
Yeah, no, and that's, I mean, I've heard many stories like that, but it is always surprising. Can you take us back to life before January 15th, 1982? I mean, from what I understand, you know, the odd day you'd go out and play some basketball, maybe you'd listen to the Bee Gees, and you'd hang out at your family beach house on the Caspian Sea.
That's right. That's exactly how it was. My father was a ballroom dancing instructor and my mother was a hairdresser. And we were a middle-class family living in Tehran before the revolution. And the Shah the king of Iran, had really westernized the country. So I went to a wonderful school for girls and I had like a 98% average. I wanted to become a medical doctor. At the time, women could become cabinet ministers and judges and anything they wanted. So the road seemed to be clear. And as you said, you know, I listened to Western music. I read Jane Austen. We owned a cottage by the Caspian. And I wore bikinis on the beach and danced to the tunes of the Bee Gees. And, you know, when I turned 12, I had my first boyfriend, and you know, everything seemed, you know, now that I look back, it's kind of comparable to how the life of a teenager would be here in the West. But then the revolution happened and everything changed.
Yeah, everything changed indeed. I mean, I can imagine you sitting there in class with a 98% average, wanting to grow up and be a doctor, and in comes this young sort of substitute teacher with all sort of propaganda coming out of her mouth, and you sort of chirp up. You know, you and me have the same problem. We can't keep our mouth shut, can we?
That is a problem. That's a big problem. Now, I hope you didn't end up in prison for that.
Well, no, I was asked not to come back to 4 different schools because of that.
Well, you know, that's not too bad. You know, if they had asked me not to come back, I wouldn't have gone back anyhow.
Yeah.
I actually stopped going to school before I was arrested. So that school year, I wasn't in school. I was studying on my own at home. So, but they still didn't, you know, they didn't settle for that. So they put me in prison.
Well, there was the big strike, and did they not blame you for that?
Well, they blamed me for that. But to be honest, you know, when that happened, I was 14 years old.
Well, how do they blame a 14-year-old for a general strike?
Well, because I dared speak up. That is why, you know, they expected everybody to be like sheep, to just do as they are told. And I was obviously not that kind. And, you know, the strike wasn't the only thing. It was also that I was writing articles against the government in a school newspaper that was basically a piece of cardboard I put up on a wall somewhere in school every morning. And it was a cat-and-mouse game between me and the principal, who was also a member of the Revolutionary Guard. You know, don't forget that every revolution, if you look at the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, it has a cultural revolution following it. So this was the Iranian Islamic Cultural Revolution. And how do you succeed in that? You brainwash the young generation. And, of course, if there is a young person, well, actually, at the time, there were many of us young people who didn't want to settle.
Well, yeah, because did you not lead a little bit of a walkout in your class?
That is right. Yes, we walked out on the calculus teacher. It wasn't anything political. I basically just raised my hand and said to her, can you please teach calculus instead of propaganda? And she said, well, you don't like what I teach, leave. You know, I had grown up watching Little House on the Prairie and the Donny and Marie Osmond show. And then suddenly, you know, your world completely, every rule that has held your world together suddenly changes. So as a teenager, and teenagers, they protest. They protest the color of the wall, even if they don't have anything better.
But you were raised in a family that had fairly, how do I say this? It was a free-thinking, creative family. I mean, your father had to work as a translator because dancing had been ruled satanic.
And that's correct, yes, because after the revolution, you couldn't dance, you couldn't wear anything pretty, you couldn't sing, you couldn't do anything. Anything that was fun was suddenly illegal. So it was, it is a very difficult world for a teenager who has actually lived for 12, 13, 14 years having fun, suddenly being told that that is all illegal and satanic. You naturally rebel, and that's exactly what happened in my school, in all the schools around the country in the early 80s. There was a huge rebellion of teenagers.
Okay, you need to tell me about Andre, because that's the story behind the story.
You
were, and here's the only thing that kind of, I don't know, maybe it's a different culture over there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Frank and Kathy Lee Gifford have 25 years difference between them, but they got married when they were adults. You were 16 when you started dating Andre, who was 23.
That's right. Yes, there was seven years between us. At the time, you have to consider that the Christians in Iran are a very small minority.
Right.
There are far less than 1% of the population, far less. You know, so I cannot give you a percentage here, but I know that, basically religious minorities in Iran altogether, you put the Jewish, the Christians, the Baha'i, everybody, Zoroastrians, you put them all together, they are 1%.
Wow.
And the Christians are a really small minority. And out of that Christian population in Iran, the majority are either Armenian, Assyrian, or Chaldean. So our community, because I was born, my parents, both of my grandmothers, they were Russian Orthodox, but then I decided to go to Catholic Church. I was baptized at Catholic Church, and all of that. So I became Catholic. This is a Roman Catholic Church in Tehran.
Yes.
And we were a very small community. I don't know how many we were at the time, but probably like 1,000 people. You know, something like that. And, the people at the church mostly either had, let's say, Russian or Hungarian or Polish origins. And some of them, we had a few Lebanese as well. So it was a very small community. And, imagine, young people at the time, like in the early 80s, we didn't have anywhere to go. You couldn't go out with a guy, like as a young girl, and go and have a burger with him or anything like that. So the church was a safe haven because in Iran, as a Christian, you're allowed to go to church, you're allowed to celebrate Christmas as long as it doesn't get in the way of the government.
Right.
So if you don't interfere with politics, if you don't try to convert Muslims into Christianity, you mind your own business, you're fine. So inside the church, we had the safe haven where we could worship, we could get together, the young people, if we just get together and put on a show for Christmas, we would get together and have meal together back there at the back. And, that is where Andre and I met. I was in the choir and he was the organist.
Wow.
And we just liked each other, before I was arrested.
It was love at the first stanza.
It was, yeah, exactly. But, we hadn't even kissed. Like, it was a very shy, kind of very young kind of love, and then I was arrested.
Okay, well, take us right to then, and then we're going to come back and talk about Andre in a minute, because that love story behind this is unbelievable. January 15th, 1982, if I understand things right, you're just kind of getting ready to have a bath, the doorbell rings, and in come two Revolutionary Guards walked in and pointed a gun at you.
Yes. I opened the bathroom door and there were guns pointed in my face. Again, I have to put emphasis on this. You have grown up reading Jane Austen. and then there are guns pointed in your face. People ask me, like, were you scared? What were you feeling? To be honest with you, I wasn't feeling anything. There was nothing. Why? Because when you're 16 and this happens, you enter a state of shock. You don't understand what's happening. You don't get it, basically. And I was looking at my father, and he was crying. I was thinking, what's wrong with him? Why is he crying? There's nothing wrong here. So they put me in a car. It was like watching a movie. You know, you're watching a movie, and, you know, there are all these scary things happening. There are people with guns, or, you know, that sort of thing. But you are not a part of the story.
No, it was a very disassociated moment.
Absolutely. And I remained that way probably for a good part of my time, maybe for all of my time in prison. There was a distance between me and what was happening. That actually, I think that distance really protected me.
Did they take you right to, is it Evan? Is that how you say the prison?
Straight in. Yes, we went straight in. A lot of people, you know, who were arrested during those years in Iran, they would be taken somewhere else first. But with me, what happened was that because our principal had given our names and that we were anti-revolutionaries to the course of Islamic justice, so there was no need for them to evaluate the situation and see, okay, are these people really anti-revolutionaries or not? So all of the people whose names were on that list, they went straight to Evan.
Yeah, to Evan University.
Yes, that's what they use, because they say we are trying to rehabilitate these people, like to teach them a thing or two about what's right and what's wrong. And that's what they call it. And, you know, what they don't mention is that the methods to do that were torture and extreme intimidation. And that is how they educated people.
Okay. You have told your story countless times, so I don't want to make you do this. Let me read something here. You were tied to a bed. Your bare feet were beaten with a length of black electrical tape. You say it's difficult to describe the pain of that first strike, but even now, when I think about it, the soles of my feet begin to hurt. Your interrogators demanded to know who your friends were, took bets on how many lashes a teenage girl could take. They figured that you wouldn't get past 10 lashes, but it took 16 lashes before you passed out.
I didn't exactly pass out. What happened was that I lost the ability to concentrate on anything, like even to think what comes after 16. So I was awake. Like, I haven't really met anybody who has passed out under that.
Right.
I don't know what happens, but you don't pass out. And they know that. Like, with a lot of people, what they do is they pause and they give you time to kind of come to it, and then they start again. And with a lot of people, what they would do is that they would untie you. They would make you walk around because the feet get really swollen. And they want the swelling to go down so that they can actually beat you more. So then they would make you walk around, which is horrendously painful, and then they would tie you off again, and they will beat you again. And what happens is that you lose the ability to think, like completely. And, you know, they wanted something from me. They wanted information on this girl. I didn't know where she was, so they were wasting their time entirely. I had no idea. So they keep on beating me. They keep on asking, where is she, where is she? And I keep on saying, I don't know, which is the truth. But it is a fact that if I knew where this girl was, I would have told them. I would have done anything to get out of that. The problem was that I didn't have what they wanted.
So see, people on the outside would say, well, why didn't you lie? Why didn't you say, oh, she's over on this street. I saw her over here. Just give her something. Give them anything.
Give them anything, yes. I think, you know, now that I look back, I ask the exact same question. I think the problem was that I was too young. You know, I really honestly believed that I have nothing to hide, that I am telling the truth, and because I am telling the truth, I'm going to get through this. You know, this is the way I had been raised. You know, all of my young years, you know, my grandmother was always standing over there and saying, Marina, it doesn't matter what happens. If you tell the truth, you're going to be okay. So I thought, I'm telling the truth. Why should I lie and then get in trouble? I'm going to tell them the truth and they are going to get it. But they didn't.
Marina, I'm not even sure. I mean, let me just be a little direct. Aside from the story with Ali, because we're going to talk about that next, were you raped?
No, aside from that, no. But I definitely see that as rape. You know, regardless of the, you know, I have been severely criticized. I have been called a traitor and a whore. I'm sorry for using that word, but that is exactly what I have been called because I broke under torture, because I married Ali, because I converted to Islam and all of that. You know, and I have no excuse for that. This is exactly what I did. But I was 16 years old.
Yes.
And I just simply could not take it. You know, now what Ali did to me, you know, it was wrong. It was rape under the name of marriage. But, you know.
Yeah, well, let's bring people up to speed on this.
Okay.
You were brought out to be executed in front of a firing squad. And one of the interrogators drives up in the car, has paperwork that says that you aren't to be executed. And this gentleman is Ali. And he cut your bindings, put you in his car, and drove you back to the jail. And then basically he says to you, now tell me if I've got this right. He says to you, I'm connected. I just saved your life. But you need to marry me and convert to Islam, or I'm going to hurt your family.
That's exactly what he said. And, you know, I saw, because actually there was a gap in time between when he saved me from execution. I was actually sent to the cell block for a few months, and I lived there with hundreds of other girls. 90% of them are under the age of 18. And then after 5 months, he calls me back for interrogation, and then he tells me all of that stuff, that you have to marry me or I will arrest your parents and Andre.
And he would execute Andre. Now, he knew that this is the man you loved.
Yes, he knew, because I was being watched before I was arrested.
Right,
so
right,
he
right.
knew everything, absolutely everything about me.
Marina, when you're in the middle of this hell.
Yes.
You cry out to God.
Yes.
Multiple times.
Yes.
And you're not being rescued. Your prayers aren't being answered. You continue to be tortured.
Yes.
Where did God go in all of this?
Well, you know, now that I look back, now I have a little bit more perspective than I did when I was 17 years old and in the middle of it all. But God was there. If God wasn't there, I wouldn't have made it. If God wasn't there, it would have been impossible for me to be sitting here and talking to you on the phone.
Hmm.
God taught me many lessons. I learned a lot of lessons in that prison. And even though it was hell on earth, now when I look back, I realize that if, you know, I had a fairy godmother, and she came and she said, do you want to make any changes? I wouldn't ask her to get me out.
Come on.
No, I wouldn't. I honestly, you know, God is my witness. I honestly wouldn't. Because that time in the prison, you know, I got to know beautiful people. I got to know these young girls who are honestly the best people I have ever met in my life. They were beautiful and innocent and strong and brave and all of that. And they also, of course, they had their weaknesses. But at the same time, you know, what I learned in that prison, for example, Ali, you know, and what he did to me, I hated him. I hated that man because he threatened me and he forced me into a relationship that I didn't want to be in. And I was absolutely helpless. He could have done to me whatever his heart desired. And he did that. But at the same time, he took me on short leaves of absence to see his family. And then his family, his mom and his dad, they were normal people. They were good people. They, you know, his mother, the first time, opens the fridge and puts all the food in the fridge in front of him and says, eat, eat, eat. And then she tells me that her son, Ali, my torturer husband, was a prisoner in Evin prison during the time of the Shah, and he had been tortured for 3 years.
Wow.
So I saw in him, suddenly, it was like my eyes were open, and I saw that this man, that who is a torturer, who is an interrogator, who is somebody I hate, who has been raping me over and over, he is a victim. And this also made it clear for me, you know, yeah, I was in solitary confinement at the time. You have a lot of time to think. So I thought about it, that I'm a victim today. Does this mean that I will turn into a torturer tomorrow?
Well, you know, I relate to your story so much, but one thing that hit home with me was that you and I are the same age, and we have children the same age.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when it's someone in your own category, so to speak, who could have been the waitress serving me at Swiss Chalet, it really, really hits home. And yet the one thing I fail to comprehend is how, Marina, does someone convert to another religion when they really don't believe it?
you basically say the words. You don't really convert. You know, Ali said you have to say these words. You have to say, I believe in Allah and in Muhammad as his prophet.
So how can your people call you a traitor then when they know darn well that you don't believe that? And you never did believe that.
They
and you came
care.
Out of it and they don't care.
They don't care.
No.
You're talking about this whole issue from, an open-minded, accepting perspective. But in Iran, when I was even released from, I was released from the prison, and I go home, and the first thing I do, I go back to my church, I go to confession, and then I continue seeing Andre, and then 15 months later, we marry in the church in Tehran. So, but at the same time, everybody in my family, everybody we knew, our friends, relatives, everybody said, Marina, don't marry Andre. They see you, the government of Iran sees you as a Muslim woman now. They don't care that you didn't mean it, that you were faking, that they forced you, all of that. They see you as a Muslim woman, and a Muslim woman is not allowed to marry a Christian man. This is a death sentence again.
Yeah.
This is another death sentence hanging over your head. But you know what? I was sick and tired of it. I was sick and tired of being forced into this direction and that direction. And I said, you know what? I don't care.
Yeah. 8 weeks pregnant. Ali's family is thrilled. As a matter of fact, you're probably closer to his family than you were to your own mother just because of the distance that you and your mother had in between.
Completely. Ali's parents were very generous, very kind, and very communicative people.
But that's just got to be confusing to your brain.
It was. It was. And it really threw me off. And, you know, I'm grateful because they made it possible for me to see Ali not as a torturer, that, you know, the way I had known him, but as a human being with terrible flaws and a lot of pain. This doesn't mean that, you know, it was okay what he was doing to me.
No,
it wasn't okay.
Coming to the prison to rape you just because he's married to you, because so he can.
That
you're not excusing that, of course.
No, not at all. If he were alive today, I would have wanted him to stand trial, not only for what he did to me, but for what he did to other people. But deep in my heart, I know that throughout history, there's a cycle. You know, the victim becomes the torturer becomes the victim. The victim becomes the torturer. So who's the good guy, who's the bad guy here?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and then one day you saw a couple of men coming in on a motorcycle. One of them was taking aim, and Ali shoved you to the ground and threw himself on top of you, and he was killed. Correct?
Yes, that's right.
But, I mean, this sounds so melodramatic. But honestly, his last words were to his father, saying, Father, please take her to her family?
Yes, he did.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, it is interesting because at the time, the prosecutor of Tehran, who was the warden of Evin prison, and he was known as the butcher of Evin, his name was Asadullah Lojavardi, Ali had gotten in a clash with this man. You know, right now with what's going on in Iran, you see that there are different factions in the government, and these factions go at each other with a lot of hatred. You know, they're really going at each other right now. These factions used to exist back in the 80s. So when I was in the prison, inside the prison, these factions were going at each other. So this faction that Ali belonged to and this faction that the warden of the prison belonged to, they were two different ones, and they were going at each other and they were killing each other. Of course, at that time, things, you know, there was no internet, there was no YouTube, so it wouldn't be on TV every day. But it was going on, and I was a witness there. The prosecutor of Tehran, whom I heard that he ordered the assassination of Ali, he wanted to marry me off after Ali died to another one of the guards. And it was Ali's family, Ali's father, who said, no, you're not doing this. She's our daughter-in-law. And they had a lot of money. They had a lot of influence, and they worked my way out of that prison. And something that's interesting is that Asadullah Lojavardi, that guy who was the warden of the prison, he was assassinated in Tehran in 1998 in broad daylight.
Wow. Wow. This is just an unbelievable story. We're going to say goodbye in a couple of minutes here to Marina. Again, thank you for your heart, for your time, for sharing your story with the world. Because when you summarize it, when you wrap it all up, it looks like this. In just over 2 years, you had lost a husband. You'd miscarried your baby, you've been forced to turn your back on your religion, been raped, been tortured, witnessed the death and defilement of a generation of your contemporaries.
That's exactly what it was. I completely lost the way of life. And, you know, in the chaos, I kind of, you know, temporarily even lost who I was.
Hmm. And yet, and here's how we finish the story, you come back to Andre. And Andre knows what has happened to you. He and not because you've told him, because you didn't tell him for a long, long time. As a matter of fact, it wasn't until the book came out.
That's right. Yes, we didn't exactly talk.
No, you didn't get into details.
No.
But he knew where you were. He knew the reputation of that prison.
Oh, he did. Yes, everybody did. They just didn't talk about it.
And here's the catcher. Here's the line, folks. If this isn't unconditional love, I don't know what is. Even if you had come home with a baby in your arms, I would have loved you just as much.
That's right. That's the kind of guy he is.
He's
still exactly the same. He still loves me unconditionally. I'm still doing crazy, crazy, crazy dangerous things. And he's still supporting me because he is just a very good, good man.
You're an amazing woman. And I know you'll deflect this, and so I'll do it for you. Not only are you an amazing woman, but this God you have is pretty amazing as well.
Oh, I think he is, because it's a miracle that I'm here.
Marina Nemat is who we've been chatting with. And again, the book is Prisoner of Tehran, a memoir. And you can go to her website. You can buy the book through Amazon. And thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Marina.
Thank you so much for having me, Drew. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Wow. What a story. Again, Marina Nemat is the website. MarinaNemat. MarinaNemat.com. Prisoner of Tehran. This book has won countless awards and rave reviews. It's been out for a couple of years now. What a story. A short break. When we return, Monica Schroeder, Canadian singer-songwriter, joins us in studio. And then Wayne Jacobson, author and publisher of Windblown Media. He wrote a book that rocked my world as well. The Shack, you of course know that. But this book, So You Don't Want to Go to Church Anymore. Wow. I think I should stop saying wow. I've just overwhelmed with all this stuff today. We'll be right back.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.